From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Perennial basketball rivals Duke and UNC will meet in Durham today to the delight of boisterous Tar Heels and Blue Devils fans. Ahead on Only a Game, meet some unusual North Carolina scholars who, weirdly, can safely root for both schools. Also, college hoop guru Pat Forty goes from killing trees to just dressing up as one, and we remember Brett Favre's football career. Also ahead, hoop dancing in Arizona and a look at baseball's dark side, past and present.
As you look through the history of our national game, what you see is America, both in its glories and in its vices.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. I thought that I would never see Pat Forty dressed up as a tree, but as a tree, Pat Forty dressed, and Stanford fans were briefly blessed to see him, tree-like, mascot Pat, and Stanford won. He may be back. Joining me now to discuss the men's side of the college basketball world as various teams sort out the shape of the postseason is former Stanford tree mascot Pat Forty. Pat, I understand last week you came out of the tree costume somewhat worse for wear, so I hope you didn't bark your shins.
Didn't bark my shins.
Isn't that awful? Awful.
Uprooted myself just fine, came back to Kentucky, and I'm glad I did it, and I will never do it again.
Well, what led to your appearance as the tree mascot at a Stanford game?
Well, it was truly the be careful what you wish for moment there. About a month ago, I had written a basketball bucket list, taking off on the movie, you know, mm-hmm. things you want to do before you kick the bucket, and one of them, number three on the list, was to be the Stanford tree. Wrote it, you know, said, oh, it looks like fun, never thought anything else about it, and then about 5 days later came an email from the Stanford band, of which the tree is part, asking if I would like to be the tree, and it was truly time to tree up or shut up, and so I treed up and actually went out there because I couldn't think of a good excuse not to.
Yeah.
And performed for the first half of their game, Stanford's game against Washington. I was a bad tree. I was a wooden tree, I would say, mm-hmm. but enjoyed the experience. No.
Well, I'm sure you were relieved when you could leave.
Absolutely. Shed those leaves. Move on.
So Stanford won that game 72-69 over Washington, but it seems like the Cardinal could have used your inspirational tree skills in Thursday's overtime loss to UCLA. With the win, the number two Bruins clinched their third straight Pac-10 title. UCLA has been to two straight Final Fours. They have no titles to show for that. Are the Bruins poised for a happier ending this year?
Well, I tell you, the main thing Stanford needed, Bill, was a decent referee on the floor at the end of the game. They got just absolutely jobbed, I thought, at the end of regulation on a block shot against Darren Collison's with 2.5 seconds left that was somehow called a foul. He made the free throws, and then UCLA won in overtime. Mm-hmm. So, you know, congratulations to UCLA for pulling it out in the OT. But I still think that, you know, UCLA, yes, has a chance to win the national title, but there's still a lot of unskilled labor on that team, a lot of their post players that can't put the ball in the basket. They rely very heavily on Darren Collison and Kevin Love to do almost everything. And outside of that, I still think there are weaknesses there. It's a good team, but it's not a bulletproof team by any stretch.
UCLA could end up the number one team if Duke can pull off the season sweep over top-ranked North Carolina tonight. The number five Blue Devils have already won in Chapel Hill earlier this year. Does that make them the favorite to win at home?
I don't think so, no, because Taiwan Lawson, the jet-quick North Carolina point guard, did not play in that first game after spraining an ankle. Is expected to play in this game. He's still not back to his old explosive self, but Carolina is better without him, or with him, I'm sorry, than without him. And, you know, I just think that Carolina is the better team, and we didn't see them at full strength in February, but we will this time, and I expect Carolina victory, although, you know, in this series, nothing's ever handed to you.
The Tennessee Volunteers have sewn up their first regular season SEC title in 40 years with a win over Florida this week. The Vols have the look of a number one seed, I would think. Will fans have the pleasure of seeing Coach Bruce Pearl in his bright orange blazer along the sideline in the Final Four?
It's possible. You know, they're one of, to me, like seven or eight teams that are right there in the mix. You know, their issue is defense. They don't play a ton of it. but they score a whole lot of points and they play at the tempo they want to play. Great perimeter team, okay interior team. One of those teams where stylistically they cause a lot of problems for everybody that they play. They're veteran, they're experienced. Tennessee has never had any significant NCAA tournament success. Last year, I believe, was their first Sweet 16 ever. So it would be uncharted territory for all of them. But, they definitely have a chance to be there.
Number 6, Kansas, seems to be doing well these days. They beat in-state rival Kansas State last week. They beat Texas Tech by a mere 58 points. However, Kansas has a history of playing well before the tournament and then losing to teams like Bucknell in the first round. Do the Jayhawks buck that trend this year?
I have to think so. Now, can they buck it all the way to the Final Four? They are playing as well and have as much talent as anybody in the country. They have more depth, more experience. Can play inside or outside. They play good defense. What they don't have is a track record. Bill Self has never been to a Final Four. None of the players, obviously, have never been to the Final Four. So, that's the bugaboo they have to get over. And it's been a long time since a coach who had never been to a Final Four won on his first try. I believe it was Jim Calhoun in 1999 was the last one. So, you wonder if they can get there and win the whole thing. On paper, absolutely have a chance, but they've got to solve the issue between their ears.
Before the national tournament begins, a lot of the field of 65 will be filled out according to what happens in the conference tournaments, most of which begin next week. Is there a tournament that you'll be keeping an eye on, or will there be multiple TVs at the 40 household this week on all hours of the night?
Oh, you better believe it. All hours, day and night. I love championship week because there's so many tournaments going on. Games in the middle of the day, you can play hooky from work by watching and seeing what's going on, anywhere from the Sun Belt Conference, which I think could be a fascinating final between South Alabama and Western Kentucky, two teams with about 25 wins but are both on the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Davidson has won 20 games in won 20-0 in the regular season in the Southern Conference, but are they a lock? Not yet. And, then you get to the big tournaments, and I think a lot of those, I think the Big East should just be fantastic. There's, four or five teams, I think, in the Big East that have regional final kind of potential. So it should be a lot of fun.
Pat Forde covers college basketball for ESPN and ESPN.com. Pat, make like a tree now. Time for you to leave.
All right, Bill. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Today, fifth-ranked Duke will host the University of North Carolina, currently the number one men's team in the country. Since Duke and UNC are close geographical neighbors and both are basketball powerhouses, their rivalry is one of the most intense in all of sports. Rachel McCarthy recently talked with students from each school who offer unique perspectives on the often contentious hoops world inhabited by Tar Heels and Blue Devils, and she has our report.
While Carolina was still riding up Route 15501 to play Duke in March 2006, the pregame frenzy was already in full swing. ESPN was running retrospectives of the epic matchups from years past. The announcers were still in a tizzy over Duke stealing a win at Carolina earlier in the season. And hundreds of Duke fans were waiting expectantly to get into Cameron Indoor Stadium after weeks of camping out for tickets. Little did those dedicated fans know there were enemies among them. Sitting outside the UNC Student Union recently, Alex Snyder recalls with some pride how he and his friends managed to hide their Tar Heel garb, pile into one of the Duke student cheer sections, and just before tip-off.
We took off our Duke blue, we took out our face paint that was in our pockets, we put it on, and we were cheering for our Tar Heels.
Bewildered Duke fans bristled when they realized their ranks had been infiltrated. UNC won the game, and Duke's Cameron Crazies, known for their clever, or depending on your perspective, obnoxious heckling, were not happy. Security guards were dispatched to make sure the Carolina fans got out unscathed.
And we were escorted out to chants of, this is not one of Duke's finer moments, chants of, safety school, safety school, which hurt a little bit,
The jeer about UNC's alleged lowered mission standards were also a bit off target, since Snyder and his fellow infiltrators were Robertson scholars. Robertsons are a highly select group of students who attend either Duke or UNC, in this case UNC, but take classes and even live at the other school over the course of their college careers. The program aims to build bridges between two institutions that are constantly competing.
Opposites attract.
Art Chansky is author of a 2005 book on the rivalry called Blue Blood.
Small private school versus a big state university. It's mainly out-of-state students versus in-state students. if you're a Carolina fan, you know the Carolina players, and you know the Duke players almost as well. If you're a Duke fan, you certainly know your players, but you know everything about Carolina. From that standpoint, they're fans of the rivalry as much as they are fans of their own school.
It's that us-versus-them mentality that Chansky says makes this rivalry so strong. Alex Snyder knows all about it.
Well, I mean, I had a roommate at UNC, and he is the kind of born and bred Tar Heel, kind of his parents' parents, all UNC. Guy has like a, you know, UNC bedspread. When he heard I was leaving him, not only leaving him, but leaving him for Duke, he didn't talk to me for a good 4 months.
After the March 4th, 2006 incident at Cameron, many of Snyder's Duke friends didn't want to be associated with him either. But for Snyder, sneaking into the game wasn't really about slighting Duke. It was about cheering for his team, while also sharing in Duke traditions, like tenting in the middle of winter, and soaking in the indescribably loud, frantic, hot and sweaty scene at Cameron during the most anticipated game of the year. Sort of a subversive spin on the shared Duke-UNC experience the Robertson program is supposed to be all about. Duke's student government didn't agree and banned the Robertson scholars from tenting for tickets.
The rivalry is very sexy.
Robertson scholar Yusuf Abugarbia is a Duke student living at UNC. He and Snyder agree while people on both sides take things to the extreme, the media also amps up the rivalry.
It's one of those things that it's very easy to put in sort of like a literary relationship. Oh my God, we've got two schools, you know, 8 miles from one another, they hate each other. I mean, it's one of those things, try to make it fit a template. And I think one of the things that we've learned is it doesn't exactly fit that template.
Do you feel like it's overplayed?
No, I mean, basketball is definitely important, especially when, you know, you got two top five teams. You guys are still top five. We're still, okay, good. Just checking.
While the rivalry does matter to a lot of people, says Abugarbia, not everyone gets carried away with it.
I mean, there are plenty of people at both Duke and Carolina, at least from my experience, that are sort of lukewarm fans. If they're winning, you know, they're really excited. But if a team loses, they're not going to be depressed the next day. There's always the diehard fan who, like, went and painted himself, you know, stood out in line for like 3 weeks, got bronchitis. Like those people are going to be depressed. But I mean, like the guy who's watching at home in his apartment or in the common room in the dorm is not similarly invested.
Abugarbia says he's one of those lukewarm Duke fans. But as a Robertson scholar, he identifies strongly with both schools. Abugarbia likens his situation to having divorced parents, albeit one in which he can live happily in two different worlds. There'll be no split loyalties for Abugarbia, or likely anyone else when it comes to today's Duke-Carolina game at Cameron Indoor Stadium. Even writer Art Chansky will let his true Carolina blue colors show, from his seat nice and far from the Cameron crazies.
You know, I don't want to get into any confrontation with anybody. I won't paint my face, I won't stand up and scream and yell. You know, I'll just consider myself lucky that I'm there.
For Only a Game, I'm Rachel McCarthy in Durham, North Carolina.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. After scoring a goal against Portsmouth last weekend, Everton midfielder Tim Cahill celebrated by running around the pitch while pretending that he was in handcuffs. It was the first time Cahill had acknowledged on the field that his older brother Sean is serving a 6-year jail sentence. The celebration caused considerable dismay, especially among police officers who were unhappy with Cahill's dedication of a goal to his incarcerated brother. Cahill later apologized, saying the gesture was spontaneous and he hadn't meant to offend anybody. Some questioned his sincerity when Cahill added that his brother, quote, is happy in jail. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Hopi Indian jumps through hoops for Hollywood fame. But first,
I'd like to thank the Packers for giving me an opportunity as well. I hope that every penny that they've spent on me they know it was money well spent.
That was former Green Bay Packer quarterback Brett Favre, barely able to make it through Thursday's press conference, where he announced his storied 17-year NFL career is officially over. The news surprised some observers, given that in January the Packers were just one interception away from a Super Bowl appearance and Favre enjoyed one of his best seasons. Wisconsinites in particular are struggling with the idea of fall Sundays without Favre, who started for the Packers in an NFL record 253 consecutive regular season games. Joining me now on the line is Tom Silverstein, who covers the Packers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's great to be back, Bill.
Brett Favre usually looked so happy when he was on the field playing. Was it jarring for you to see him so upset during Thursday's press conference?
Well, the one thing about him is he always played with emotion, you know, whether it was joy or the agony of defeat, as they say. I was not surprised that he broke down. I mean, this is a tough moment for the guy. He's known nothing but football, really, for more than 20 years. Mm. You know, his father was a football coach. He grew up playing football. He's been a star quarterback for as long as anybody can remember. And he's just really poured all his energy into the game. And I think it was really hard for him to make this decision. And I think you saw how hard it was on Thursday.
It sounds as if you think there may be some difficulty for Brett Favre making the transition from star NFL quarterback to something else.
I do. I was very interested. I thought one of his comments struck me, and that was that he does not have a plan for retirement. And in my experience covering sports, many of the guys who did retire and had the best retirements did have a plan. They knew what they were going to do when they got out of the game. Now, they might have taken a rest for a couple of years, but they had stuff in place that could somehow keep them busy and help them with the transition. You know, he expressed how burned out he is and tired and mentally fatigued, and I think that's good for him to be idle for a while. But this is a guy who for the past 16 years has studied day in and day out and practiced and never had really a day to himself during the season. He's going to really find himself with a lot of idle time, and I don't know how he's going to handle that.
Brett Favre's waffling between playing and retirement had been one of the NFL's recurring off-season stories for several years. When Favre announced that he was quitting, did you believe him?
Well, I'll tell you, I believed it because of the announcement. What I don't believe, and even as we stand here now, is that there won't come a time in the next month or two when he doesn't have a strong feeling about coming back and start to contemplate whether he can do it. I don't think he'll be able to come back here because the Packers are moving on, and in some ways I think they nudged him out a little bit. I think they're ready to move on and start a new era. I think their general manager, Ted Thompson, felt like it might have been time to move on. It's going to be an interesting situation. I would predict, and I really feel strongly, that at some point before training camp starts in July, that you're going to hear some kind of report somewhere that Brett Favre wants to play again.
Tom, there may be folks listening to the program who are wondering what all the fuss is about, because after all, pro athletes retire all the time. Can you describe the impact of Favre's retirement for our listeners who may not appreciate what a beloved figure he has been in Green Bay and in Wisconsin?
Yeah, and I think it's beyond that. I think it really is a national phenomenon. I wouldn't say he's akin to Michael Jordan, but he's close. He's football's face. And the reason is because of how he played the game, the joy and sort of boyhood disposition he had when he was on the field. And, of course, the NFL loved that, and they marketed it heavily. But I think people really responded to that this was a guy who really didn't play for the money. You know, this is not a guy who was pretentious. He's not a guy who really enjoyed the limelight. He just put up with it. And I think in that sense, he was really someone that carried the flag for the NFL as a whole. And in Wisconsin, he's an absolute icon. one of the reasons is that, you know, there's a whole generation of people now who only know him as the Green Bay Packers quarterback. They don't know Bart Starr. You know, they maybe remember Don Majkowski for the year and a half that of success he had. But Brett Favre is who they grew up with. You know, I don't know if it's the same as the Beatles, but it really is like you kind of grew up with the guy during that time. And I think that's probably explains his popularity.
Aaron Rodgers is the new starting quarterback for the Packers. How difficult will it be for him to replace the most popular player in Green Bay history?
It's going to be brutal. I would not want to be Aaron Rodgers. I think this might be one of the hardest, most difficult jobs that anybody in the NFL has ever had. I mean, let's look at the guys who retired in the NFL in Dan Marino in Miami. Here it is almost 7 years later or 9 years later, and they still don't have a quarterback. And so, you know, you have these legends, and it's no coincidence that people can't replace them. There's just so much pressure and so much, you know, these shoes they have to fill. And it's going to be difficult for Aaron Rodgers. The one thing he's got going for him is he has been here 3 years learning under Favre. And the other quarterbacks who did that, many of the other quarterbacks who did that in Green Bay and eventually wound up in other places, they've had success. Matt Hasselbeck in Seattle, Ty Detmer, Aaron Brooks. These are all guys the Packers drafted, you know, thinking someday Favre wasn't going to be able to play. And they all had, you know, left in free agency without ever having started a game. But they were successful elsewhere. And part of that is they were groomed behind him. And so, you know, there is a chance he'll be good, but they're going to have to build the team in other areas so the pressure is off him.
Tom Silverstein covers the Packers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was a joy and a pleasure.
If you're a technophobe like me, you may wonder what a podcast is. Let's consult the dictionary. Pod, a school of marine mammals, such as seals, whales, or dolphins. Cast, to throw with force or hurl. So if you'd like to throw dolphins with force, hurl whales, or listen to all of Only a Game's weekly offerings, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Last month, more than 60 Native American dancers from across North America converged on Phoenix's Heard Museum for the annual World Championship Hoop Dance Contest. Part dance, part sport, part cultural showcase, the event drew more than 10,000 spectators. One of the star competitors was an Arizona teenager who's parlayed hoop dancing fame into a budding Hollywood career. Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker was there, and he has our story.
Let's bring him out, Nakoda Lawrence.
The drumbeat starts and Nakoda Lawrence steps into the ring. The lean, willowy 18-year-old Hopi from Flagstaff dances and spins with dizzying speed, slowly picking up hoops off the ground with his feet. He weaves his body in and out of the hoops, transforming them into a kaleidoscope of designs. First a flower, then an eagle, then a flapping butterfly. The hoop dance is traditionally a healing ceremony. It's believed to have originated at Taos Pueblo in New Mexico, where it's said every time the dancer passed through the hoop, he added one day to the sick person's life. But Lawrence adds his own modern flair.
I put some breakdancing in there at the end. At one point, I'm spinning four hoops on my arms, and they're going different directions, and I do the moonwalk.
Nakoda Lawrence started dancing when he was four. He's since won five World Hoop Dancing Championships in the youth and teen divisions. As he racked up titles, he began to receive some national attention. In 2004, when he was only 14 years old, Lawrence appeared on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno.
Nakoda's going to perform a Native American dance that represents a circle or hoop, but during his performance, you'll see many images or designs found in nature.
Cool.
Cola, tocale, cola, tocale.
That's Nakota's father, Steve, who makes Hopi jewelry and pottery. He says his son didn't really grasp the significance of the appearance.
He doesn't stay up that late to watch the Tonight Show with Jay Leno that much, you know, so I had to explain to him about the program and everything and how big his viewership is and how he launches a lot of careers and everything by just having people come on and be on his show.
And that's exactly what happened for Nakota Lawrence. Shortly after his Tonight Show appearance, he made his acting debut in Steven Spielberg's Into the West TV miniseries. He's since been in several other miniseries and films. Most recently, he played one of Sitting Bull's sons in the award-winning HBO movie Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. But through it all, Lawrence has stayed humble.
I'm very fortunate for it, but I'm only that far because of my family.
Lawrence is a high school junior who wants to continue acting. He also plans to follow in his dad's footsteps as an artist. But he isn't about to give up hoop dancing.
Our next dancer in the adult division is Nakota Lawrence. From Flagstaff, Arizona, Nakota is Hopi and K-1 Nations.
At this year's Heard Museum contest, Lawrence competed in the adult category for the first time. He was one of six dancers to qualify for the final round.
I've known Nakota since he was a little boy, and he's phenomenal. He's always been a good-hearted little boy. You know, I've always really admired him for his dancing, and he's always done a really good job, and he's inspired my children as well.
That's Munti Sinkwa, also a member of the Hopi tribe. The 42-year-old is competing in the senior division. His son is dancing in the teen competition.
And I'm very, very happy that the children are dancing, because that's something that we know won't go away, you know, because it's not something that you learn in school. Whether they realize it or not, it's in their blood. The drum barely starts, they're not even near the arena, and they're all bouncing around, and I laugh every time I see it, because it's really, really good to see this being passed on, because it's something that inspires us as people.
Hoop dancing was indeed a family affair at this year's Heard Museum Championships. Many dancers in the adult and senior categories traveled to Phoenix with their kids, who competed in the youth, teen, and even Tiny Tots division, featuring dancers as young as three. Arnold Akachuk brought three of his kids to compete all the way from Merritt, British Columbia. He says for Native people across North America, the hoop represents the circle of life, and dancing is his family's way of sharing that philosophy.
Everything begins with the Creator. So with that understanding, we do the hoop dance, where everything, there's nothing at first. And when you do all these formations and you go in and out, it's going in all of your situations in life. When you go in and out of hoops, plus it, creating these formations tells a story of what was created and brings together unity and peace.
But above all, hoop dancing is simply a joy to watch. Deborah Kroll, the Heard Museum's marketing director and a member of the Salinan Tribe of California, thinks it someday could become an Olympic event.
If ever a sport grounded in Native tradition is an Olympic contender, it would be the hoop dance, because even the grading scale is just like ice skating. They grade it on the Lichen scale. It's a combination of athleticism, artistry, poise, precision, and it's just as smooth as silk when it's done right.
While dancers don't have to deal with the spotlight of the Olympics quite yet, they do have to cope with the pressure of competition. In the final round of dancing, Nakota Lawrence uncharacteristically dropped a hoop and finished sixth. The winner was Charles Denny, a Chippewa Cree from Fort Duchesne, Utah, who, like Lawrence, is 18 and was competing in the adult category for the first time. For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker in Phoenix.
You're listening to Only a Game. On our program 2 weeks ago, Steve Greenberg of the Sporting News discussed with me the potential pro football career of former Texas Christian University player Tommy Blake, who has sought treatment for depression. That conversation provoked Millie Fortune Gilpin, who hears Only a Game on KWMU in St. Louis, to write as follows: I'm a mental health professional, and I was pleased to hear that mental illness was discussed as a condition and not as a personal failure. Thank you for confronting the stigma that an ignorant scout made. Thank you for writing about Mr. Blake as a person with a mental illness and not as a casualty. Sue Kuklewicz, who hears the program on New Hampshire Public Radio, had a similar response to the story of Tommy Blake. "I hope that Mr. Blake is able to overcome his mental health issues," she wrote, "and that he will someday be able to speak candidly about his illness. What a role model he could be for young males with similar issues. I would argue that Mr. Blake's willingness to seek treatment makes him a better candidate for the NFL draft." Eric Bai, who listens to Only a Game on WVPR in Vermont, enjoyed Karen Given's story on the primitive biathlon held in his state. He wrote, "Your reporter did an admirable job of capturing the fun and camaraderie." Marshall Fields, an Ohio listener who hears the show on WOSU, was unhappy with a comment Charlie Pierce made on last week's program. He said that a lot of crackpot religious people come out of Colorado, Mr. Fields wrote. And that was pretty offensive, as I support one of the ministries I think he was referring to, Focus on the Family. I've decided that if that is the prevailing feeling from your program toward ministries out of Colorado, I will make the crappy choice of not listening to you anymore. Laura Bishop, who hears the program on NJN in New Jersey, wrote to say thank you for the tribute to W.C. Hines in last week's program and for the mention of the death of former Pittsburgh Steelers broadcaster Myron Cope, whose work she had enjoyed. On another note, she wrote, "Thanks for the coverage of women's college basketball. Sometimes it doesn't get the attention it deserves, but I can count on Only a Game to report on women's hoops on a regular basis." And finally, Catherine Silver, who gets up in the dark to go to work in Minneapolis, wrote, "You give me something to look forward to as I drive to work. You never fail to interest and entertain me." Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
He comes.
Boogity, boogity.
They go.
Boogity, boogity.
And he ain't wearing no clothes.
Oh, yes, they call him the street.
A man who interrupted last weekend's tri-series final cricket match between Australia and India at the grounds known as the Gabba in Brisbane last weekend no doubt wishes he had not done so. The streaker got a bit too close to Australian all-rounder Andrew Symonds, who crouched in his path and delivered a rugby-style shoulder charge. The streaker faces the possibility of a fine and a lifetime ban from the grounds. Andrew Symonds may be punished under the International Cricket Council's Code of Conduct, though it's unclear if there was an actual rule that prohibits roughing the streaker.
He's just in the mood to run in the new.
Oh, yes, they call him the streak.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, baseball's bad boy of the 90s, the 1890s. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Brett Favre announced his retirement this week after 17 years with the Green Bay Packers. All time, he would be number what?
I would put him at number 6 or 7 because I think he's only the second best quarterback in the history of his franchise behind the perennially underrated Bart Starr. But the number to remember about Brett Favre is 275, which means he played every time he was asked to play. In the position with the biggest bullseye on it in all of professional sports, he came to the post every day and every time they wanted him to and played. And that's his enduring legacy, not the yardage or the touchdowns or the number of completions, but the fact that he played the position every chance he had.
What's the likelihood that, at least in the short run, Favre will earn more in retirement than he did as an active player?
I think in the short run he will. He's, you know, as terrific a kind of, you know, redneck gunslinger as he actually is, he portrayed himself as one with even more talent. I think there's an entire, you know, let us call it the sophisticated Dukes of Hazzard demographic out there. He's going to make a lot of money for the next couple of years.
Elsewhere in pro football, Randy Moss must have felt pretty good about re-signing with the New England Patriots, at least until he learned what Ben Roethlisberger got to re-sign with the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Well, one is an older wide receiver and the other is a young quarterback. The one thing you have to remember about all NFL deals, of course, is that the number that they give you has nothing to do with reality, because most of it's not guaranteed. The important one there, I think, is Moss, because the New England Patriots, after a year where they were 18-1, couldn't seem to keep anybody in town. They needed to keep someone around. They went out of their way to do it. There was all kinds of crazy rumors floating around about him wanting to be reunited with Dante Culpepper and everything else. I would be very interested to know what the influence of Tom Brady on keeping Randy Moss among the Patriot brass was, because I have a feeling that the blackberries were burning up between Randy Moss and wherever, whatever beach Tom Brady was on.
There are few $400 million investments that double in the course of 1 year. Why didn't the two Americans who own Liverpool flip that premiership team, take the $800 million and run?
I don't know. But now there's an $800 million bid on the table from Dubai International Capital. Now, I can't think of anything that would endear the American owners more to the Liverpool faithful than having the American owners sell it to a company in Dubai. Considering all Liverpool did for us in 1965 by giving us the Beatles, we really could have done better by these guys than these two clowns.
The Houston Rockets, winners of 12 straight before Yao Ming's season-ending injury, have won 5 straight since losing their all-star center. Who needs a big, tall guy in the middle? No problems for Houston, right?
Usually I don't go with the whole notion that losing your best and most prominent player is a good thing for the team. This time has freed Houston up to be very athletic, a lot more fun to watch, much more in tune with the run-and-gun Western Conference. And I think that, you know, they've actually turned their season around.
There are few do-overs in pro sports, but there's going to be one tonight. And setting it up required the NBA to figure out the rules for the 51.9 seconds that the Atlanta Hawks and the Miami Heat will play. Does Miami get to bring back Shaq?
No, they don't get to bring anyone back. But Mike Bibby and Sean Marion will be able to play for their respective teams. Mike Bibby is now with the Hawks, obviously. Shaquille O'Neal was inadvertently fouled out of a game. And this is the first one of these that they've had since 1982.
Former NBA star Kevin Johnson, now running for mayor of Sacramento, said this week, quote, "We need a change in the city, and I believe we need it now." Change. Where have I heard that kind
of
campaign talk?
Watching his TV, hey, give him credit. Usually athletes who go into politics shoot for the moon. They want to go to the Senate. They want to be governor. This guy wants to be a mayor. It's a good way to start your political career. Start it at one level, and it's the capital city of California.
Baseball fans who visit the Hall of Fame on opening day might be able to see the ball that Barry Bonds hit for his 756th home run, but I guess the exact nature of the display featuring that ball is still under negotiation.
This Mark Echo character who got the ball and gave the fans a chance to vote on what to do with it, he's going to have the asterisk on, and it's going to be displayed with the asterisk. And I think, remarkably, the Hall of Fame spokesman Jeff Idelson says, the asterisk doesn't implicate Barry.
No.
Of course not! Why would we think that? It's the only thing with an asterisk in the entire Hall of Fame.
It's great for Mets fans that their team got Johan Santana, Charlie, but by the time the season begins, will there be any healthy Mets to play behind him?
Well, I was about to say, he better strike out 27 men per game, because if anyone puts the ball in play, they're going to run all the way around the plate. Carlos Delgado, out of there. Ryan Church, out of there. Brian Schneider, out of there. Carlos Beltran, out of there. And now Moises Alou. The Mets can't win for losing the last 2 years. They gave it up extraordinarily badly at the end of the last season, and now they load up again. They put the best starting pitcher in baseball onto a team that should have made the playoffs last year, and nobody can stay healthy.
Grease monkeys on the NASCAR circuit have expressed concern that Carl Edwards' loss of his oil tank lid during last weekend's race in Las Vegas was no accident. Driver Jeff Burton said, typically things don't fall off cars. He's never driven any of the cars that I've owned.
Well, apparently. Typically things don't fall off cars in race cars. Typically they're knocked off the
exactly.
race cars. So he's probably right. The feeling is, and this is one of the nice things about auto racing, one of the great things about NASCAR is it's a very, very target-rich environment for a complete paranoia. The feeling is that it was arranged for the lid to fall off to make the car faster.
Mm-hmm.
How much faster?
Lighter.
How much faster? How much does the thing weigh? And why does it already not weigh as little as possible?
You're asking me these things.
I know. Odd. It's just a strange sport.
On Tuesday, Katarina Witt gave lots of fans an opportunity to relive one of the great Olympic moments of all time. She ended her ice show career, how else, by reprising her famous Carmen performance.
I thought you were going to say she stood on the victory stand with a black glove. No? Okay, never mind. No, she did the old Carmen thing. And in the account of it, of course, she was the last great communist Olympic heroine. She skated for East Germany in 1988, which was there was only in East Germany for about another year. And Time magazine called her the most beautiful face of socialism. Remember socialism? We used to be worried about that.
And finally, Robert Cadera of Lake Villa, Illinois, may be facing charges for his actions while trying to get his 14-year-old son to a tennis tournament on time. Did he run afoul of some sort of tennis association regulation to prevent over-enthusiastic parent involvement?
Of course not. He loaded up the airplane and flew him there and landed on a golf course without telling anyone he was doing anything.
There's no rule against that. Charlie Pierce, who writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, often flies in for our conversations on Only a Game, and when he does so, he's careful to land at the airport. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Baseball is often celebrated as pastoral and lyrical, a leisurely game in which the tyranny of the clock has no place. Fair enough, but as Roger Abrams points out in his new book, The Dark Side of the Diamond, some of baseball's greatest players have been cheats, thugs, and rogues. Roger Abrams joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill.
Let's begin with one of the more startling contentions in your book, or at least it was startling to me. Who was the first baseball player to use testosterone injections in order to enhance his performance?
Well, it was a Hall of Famer whose name was Jimmy Galvin, known generally by the fans as Pud Galvin, and the first 300-game pitcher that was nearing the end of his career, was looking for something that might make a difference, and the newspapers of the time had lots of information about this new elixir of life that was created by a French-American physiologist. And so apparently, Galvin, who played in Pittsburgh for the then Pittsburgh Alleghenies, went to the local hospital and got an injection of testosterone. This was August of 1889.
Mr. Galvin must have been one desperate pitcher because he agreed to be injected with an extract of the testicles of a guinea pig and a dog, and I gotta think that maybe things weren't quite as clean in the hospitals of that day as they are now, I'm guessing.
That is true, and in fact, Galvin only played for a couple more years, but the Washington Post reports that the day after he took this injection, he had one hell of a day.
Oh, he won. Oh, he was a great victory.
It was,
yes.
It was a shutout, and he got a couple of extra base hits. This was unusual for Pud Galvin, but my guess, it was the placebo effect.
Drug use among the ballplayers of the late 19th and early 20th century was not limited to testosterone. What were some of the other substances to which early hitters and pitchers turned?
Well, they would turn to anything that seemed to work. Ballplayers at the time were paid only if they played. And it was a long season with clubs that only had 10 or 14 people on the whole club. And so to deal with the pain, there was alcohol. In addition, they would take all kinds of mixtures of strychnine. Cocaine was...
Strychnine jumped out at me. I don't know why. I kind of thought that was something that killed people.
Well, it if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger.
Okay.
And that was the hope of these baseball players. But they were a tough bunch.
When Ty Cobb coached a high school all-star team, he taught the youngsters how to cheat creatively. Rogers Hornsby, another Hall of Famer, was quoted in 1961 as saying, "You have to cheat. If I had played strictly by the rules, I'd have been home feeding my bird dogs a long time ago." Would today's fans be less upset by the use of steroids by contemporary players and by other forms of cheating if they knew the game's history?
I think, in part, what it does is it places today's contretemps into a historical context. That doesn't excuse what might be going on today, but it does explain it as part of the game, that the game includes the glories of Ted Williams' home run and the perfidy of the 1877 Louisville Grays who threw the pennant. I think as you look through the history of our national game, what you see is America, both in its glories and in its vices.
The subtitle of your book is Gambling, Violence, Drugs, and Alcoholism in the National Pastime, but the book is not without its lighter moments, at least if those moments are considered in retrospect. One of those moments involved a woman named Alice Roth. She was a Phillies fan who one August day in 1957 must have left the ballpark really wishing that she'd been somewhere else.
Well, she did leave the ballpark on a stretcher. Hmm. Now, that does happen every year at Fenway Park. Dozens of people are hit by foul balls and are injured as a result. And that happened to Alice Roth. She was put on a stretcher. The batter was still at bat.
It was Richie Ashburn, I believe.
It was the great Richie Ashburn. Right. And only Ashburn could have done this, certainly not on purpose. As they were carrying her out, Ashburn hit another foul ball right in the region of Mrs. Roth and hit her a second time.
This is not something one should laugh at, but what are the odds?
Well, you know, just take care when you go out this season. Being careful.
I hope he gave her a signed baseball bat or something.
Well, she has found her memorial in my book.
You're perhaps aware that this program, Only a Game, sometimes sinks to doggerel. According to your research, in 1886, the Atlanta Constitution ran a bit of same, and it begins, "Mother, may I slug the umpire? May I slug him right away so he cannot be there, mother, when the clubs begin to play? Let me clasp his throat, dear mother, in a dear, delightful grip with one hand and with the other bat him several in the lip." Were umpires in the game's early days in more danger than today's umpires are?
Umpires interacted with the crowd. In the beginning and in the very earliest days of the games, in the 1840s and 50s and 60s, umpires would sometimes turn to the crowd to get advice on a call.
Oh, excellent.
And, you know, then they would say, okay,
what could possibly go wrong?
What could go wrong? But there came a time as the game became a bit more violent when persons in the crowd, spectators, would not just hurl epithets at the umpires, but would hurl bottles. And most of the umpires took this, although not necessarily calmly, but there are some umpires, like Tim Hurst, who is in the Hall of Fame, who attacked his attackers with a bat, and they were not soon to return to the ball yard.
We haven't talked about gambling, the first of the four vices you mention in the subtitle of your book. It's interesting to me that you conclude that Pete Rose, banned from baseball for placing bets on games when he was managing the Cincinnati Reds, should eventually be elected to the Hall of Fame.
Well, there is no question, based on his performance on the field, that Pete Rose is a Hall of Fame.
More hits than anybody else.
Yeah, and more everything. So more games, more at-bats, more outs, in fact. His name is all over the Hall of Fame. Before this incident, the voters at the Hall of Fame never considered activities of the candidate that occurred after he ended his playing career. Pete's activities, which were certainly censurable, there is no question in anyone's mind that he bet on the games in which he managed. But those events occurred after he stopped playing. And so by Hall of Fame tradition, it should not be considered. Pete Rose deserves to be elected to the Hall of Fame, but never again in a clubhouse or in a managerial position.
What about Mark McGwire, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens?
We'll have to see on those. I think our fever with steroids will be subsiding. Then what do we do with the folks during this era? We are going to have some finality on some of those matters. Bonds has a criminal trial. And if Bonds is acquitted, he's in. If Roger Clemens wins his libel suit against Brian McNamee, he's in. If everything is left hanging, well, that's why eligibility for the Hall of Fame extends for a period of years. Every era has its own quirks. Those who were admitted to the Hall of Fame before 1945 didn't play against any players of color. And at the same time, they didn't have the same kind of nutrition as current players. Every era is different. This era allegedly is different because of both steroids and human growth hormone. We'll have to see if there is proof that those activities had any more effect on those players' ability to perform than it did for Pud Galvin in 1889.
Roger Abrams is the author of The Dark Side of the Diamond, Gambling, Violence, Drugs, and Alcoholism in the National Pastime, published by Rounder Books. Mr. Abrams, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our hoop dancing photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Dark Side of the Diamond author Roger Abrams, who reminisces about the days of yore when ballplayers could
go down to the local grocery store, get your cocaine. It was perfectly legal, and heroin, and sometimes it was mixed with wine, and that was really quite nice, I'm told.
Well, as W.C. Fields once put it, well, for the good old days, I hope they never come again. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.